It's the two megastars summer mashup, the awesome iPhone on the Rockstar Metro PCS network. Get the iPhone you've always wanted for $0 so you can jam without limits.
It's a hit. Get an iPhone SE on us when you switch. Metro PCS.
Coverage not available in some areas, plus sales tax and $10 activation fee. Requires port of number not currently active on T-Mobile network or on Metro PCS in past 90 days to an unlimited LTE plan. See store for details and terms and conditions.
Good evening, everyone. This is Shannon Fisher. Welcome to The Authentic Woman. I am your host, Shannon Fisher, and I have a fantastic guest tonight. I am so excited to welcome very accomplished and legendary artistic director, Carol Pearsall. She is the artistic director of Fifth Wall Theater, which is a theater company she started this year with her longtime colleague and associate artistic director, Billy Christopher Maupin. Carol held the position of founding artistic director of the Firehouse Theater Project from its inception in October of 1993 until December of 2012. And under her direction, during the first 5 years of the Richmond Theater Critics Circle Awards, which were not in existence for the first 14 years of the theater, the Firehouse won 20 awards, including 2 Best Play Awards and 1 People's Choice Award. It was also named the Best Theater in Richmond Magazine's public poll. Carol has been featured in the first Bell Magazine Women in the Arts issue. She was honored for being a forward-thinking female cultural leader. She was featured in Work magazine and named one of the top innovators at the forefront of the Richmond arts and culture by Style Weekly. She attended the Neighborhood Playhouse School of Theater in New York City, where she studied acting under Sanford Meisner, and she continues to teach adult Meisner classes to this day. She's worked in film, television, and theater for decades, both in New York City and in Richmond, Virginia, and she's been involved in producing a multitude of provocative, cutting-edge theater. So, Carol Pearsall, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Shannon. It's a pleasure to be here.
I am so excited to have you. There's so much to talk about with your extensive career, and I guess the best way to start is to dive right on into your current project. So I first want to ask you, you started Fifth Wall Theater, and it recently received some national press. It was in Broadway World, and that's such an interesting title for a theater company. What is the concept of the Fifth Wall?
The concept of the Fifth Wall is, you know, in theater, you break the fourth wall. The fourth wall is where you're looking out into the audience, and sometimes the actors will break that and talk directly to the audience rather than do their scene in the stage. Well, we found another boundary. The fifth wall is another boundary, and it's not quite defined. It's not often broken, but it's the boundary that that restricts creative imagination, like trying to contain it within these walls. So we want to do theater that's not predictable and safe, but theater that's breaks through the barriers, theater that goes beyond these boundaries, and theater that causes people to have a new perspective to their life, have a new perspective to a situation that they might see, have something to think about when they leave the theater. And also, we like to talk about the plays afterwards and have talkbacks with the audience after the shows. So it's theater not to entertain solely, but to take people beyond the boundaries.
So you're really kind of tapping into the audience's energy and emotion and their own philosophy. That's really
powerful. It's all about the audience, and it's all the audience. I mean, we can't do it without the audience, and it's connecting to the audience and feeling the audience and feeling what they get out of it.
Sure, sure. And that's I think that's an exciting goal to have, and I think that's a really interesting concept to build a theater around. I really do. So what is going to set Fifth Wall Theater apart from the rest? How are you going to do this, to tap into the audience's energy and emotion? Are there any particular techniques that you're going to use, or is it a matter of the work that you pick?
Well, right now we have a three-show season, and the work we've picked, we feel that the audience will embrace and will actually go away thinking about and wondering about and trying to figure out. In the future, in fact, the last show of our season is a work in progress. This will be only the second production, and it'll have a new script when it comes to us, and the playwright will be here with us. So we'll depend a lot on the audience feedback to see this play. It's a dilemma because it's about an anthropologist who works for the U.S. Army, and she is supposed to teach the Army about Iraqi culture, but she befriends an Iraqi woman, and then everything's compromised. So it's a dilemma that I don't have an answer for, that the audience is going to have to really decide for themselves and really
sure.
think about.
And how exciting that it's the second production. So this production and the audience's reaction is actually going to have input into the future of the play. What's it called?
Exactly. Yes, it's called The Human Terrain by Jennifer Blackmer.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, our audience in Richmond will have a say in the future of the play. That's for sure. And then I'm already working on next year, and I'm working on a play about women and their this will be an original play about women and their images of themselves and how they perceive themselves, whether they perceive themselves as beautiful and what they need to do to walk out the door. And it'll be audience participation, and we're developing it right here.
That's so exciting. It's so you, throughout your entire career, you brought really new and innovative things to the stage, and recently you've done some things under the umbrella of Fifth Wall Theater that you've done kind of in partnership and cooperation with some other theaters. With Virginia Repertory Theater, you produced Breast in Show, which was one of the first productions of that show. Is that right?
That's right. That was actually the second production, and the playwright was here, the conceiver was here, the lyricist, and the everybody involved with it was here, and they came to it, saw it in a new light. I said, how are we going to sell this breast in show about, how do you sell a show about breast cancer? But people were interested, and it was funny, it was poignant, it was a beautiful show, and we had some incredible discussions afterwards about people who've been through it.
So this is a musical about breast cancer.
It was a musical about breast cancer, yeah.
So how was it received by the audiences?
Incredible. People
people
just loved it. Some people said they hesitated to come, but when they saw the humanity of it, there were a lot of survivors that came. There were people that had lost people that came, but they said that it really opened up their eyes to look at it in a new way, and that's what we're all about.
That's great. That's really great. And you you staged a production of Gideon's Knot with the Hat
yes.
Theater that had for Best Ensemble, right, at the Artsy Awards.
Mm-hmm.
You won an award for that one.
Yes, we won Best Ensemble Acting for the Gideon's Knot. And unfortunately, John Adams could not be here to see it. Did meet her this summer. She worked with the Sparks New Voices. So
mm-hmm.
We got to know each other this summer, and she's a wonderful playwright. It's a heavy show, and I think she was reticent to come and see it because she'd seen it so many times, and it's not easy to go through. And
sure.
Our audiences, we created, that was almost an environmental piece. We created the Hat Theater into a classroom, including desks that the audience sat at. And
oh, wow.
We had dry erase boards on the desks that the audience members could write whatever they wanted to say to us afterwards. So it was close to environmental theater, and that worked well in that space. So you felt
sure.
like you were in the classroom.
That is great. That's and yet another way to break a barrier and to really get into the minds of the audience. You recently produced Race in partnership with the African American Repertory Theater. Where was that?
That was at the theater gym.
Okay.
And
you did an Israel Horovitz play, Lebensraum. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's right. Lebensraum. Lebensraum.
Yes. That you had originally staged 15 years earlier at a former theater company that you worked with. And we'll talk about
That's
the final
right.
A little bit later, but tell me about this production.
This production was outstanding. It was at the Jewish Community Theater, Jewish Family Theater, and I had a wonderful cast. It was it was a magical experience because the three cast members and all the crew were so excited about the project, and we just had a wonderful set. And it's very theatrical, which I love. You don't often get to see theatrical plays where they grab the props and they grab sweaters and they change costumes in front of the audience and they play different characters. And yet it's not Greater Tuna where it's hilarious. It's a real piece with real people. It is funny, but it has a real punch to it. Germany has invited 5 million Jews to come back and live in Germany. They feel bad about the Holocaust, and it's about Jews that come back and try to assimilate.
Amazing. Yeah, I can imagine that would be really, really powerful.
A very, very powerful piece. He's a brilliant playwright.
And so what is the process like when you work to collaborate with other theater companies and leaders of other companies to kind of achieve a dual artistic vision? What does it look like when you're doing something in conjunction with another theater?
Well, like with Race, we did it with African American Rep, and D.L. Hopkins, the artistic director there, was in the play. It was a total collaboration before we decide to have a partnership, and then make sure we're on the same page, make sure we want to communicate the same thing, make sure we're good with the directors and with the designers, and that we're all in agreement. And I haven't had any problem once we settle all that ahead of time before we decide to do a co-pro. It's exciting, and it's wonderful to work with another group and bring in both audiences and have great talkbacks with people from different groups. So it's great.
Sure. And for the listeners who don't know, a talkback is a meeting with the audience after a show. When the show is over, after the final bow, the actors come out and directors, and they come and they sit on the stage and they take questions from the audience. So
right.
What kinds of things about talkbacks, what do you feel like audiences really get out of that, Carol?
It's interesting. When you have a talkback, you have to ease into it and try to get past the questions about how did you learn all those lines or how did you approach your character, and try to get straight to the play. And Lane Satterfield does a beautiful job with that with New Voices, because she says ahead of time, we want to talk about the play. And I'm going to take a cue from her for the next talkbacks. But New Voices is a high school contest. It's all in Virginia, and they perform them for Spark. Spark brings these kids for a 2-week internship, and then their plays are performed in front of an audience, and there's always a talkback. And Lane does a great job of saying, we're going to go right to the nitty-gritty. We want to know what you thought of the play. So that's what you want to get to, and the audience shies away from that. But if you can get to that and get people to be honest, it opens up eyes.
Sure. And that's
it opens up eyes, because people, once one person starts being honest and truthful, another one will pipe up and say what they feel about what was said.
Yeah, it's almost level of reaching into the consciousness of the audience, allowing them to interact with other members of the audience. So that's it really kind of fits in with the whole fifth wall theme. There's a lot. You're doing so much that's really providing theater to audiences that a lot of people don't see. I mean, this is not your typical presentation of classic works. So we've talked about The Human Terrain for this season, and you've got two other shows for the season. Tell me about those.
We have, first of all, a play called H2O that I saw at the Shepherdstown Festival last summer. And that is, it's very theatrical, which I love, because it's many different scenes, but you have to have them all in the same place and just bring in a tablecloth or bring in something to set the stage. You can't really make all these different rooms. And it's about a young woman who is auditioning to play Ophelia in Hamlet, and the man who's playing Hamlet is a big movie star. And he's directing it also. She feels that her calling is to be an actor. Her calling from God is to be an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an atheist. They conflict here. It's a two-person show.
And interesting.
It's fascinating. It's a wonderful play. So we're doing that. And then we're doing The Lions. And that's a comedy, a family comedy. But I don't know if you know Nikki Silver. He is out there. We call it a black comedy, of course. It's about a man who's dying, and his wife and children gather at the bedside. And each family member has their own world. And it's about the family trying to be close but protecting their solitude. And the way Nikki Silver writes it, it's out there, but there's so many truths in it that we can all find things in our own families that we can relate to.
That's the mark of a good writer right there, that anybody can read it or see it and completely identify and understand the human aspects of the character. Well, so it sounds like you've been doing a lot of interesting things, and you've got a lot of interesting things coming up. And this
we're also bringing Clay Chapman in.
Really?
For his pumpkin pie show. We're doing that along with partnership with the Modlin Center. And Clay hasn't been here since I brought him in the firehouse years ago. He is amazing. He's a storyteller. He works with Hannah Cheek. And there's an energy in the room as soon as you walk in. And he has these amazing stories to tell. And it's hard to even describe what it is. I just know that I've been to his pumpkin pie shows in New York. I've been to two of them in Richmond, one of which I brought here, and it's a unique theater experience that nobody who sees it ever forgets.
Well, so what transpires in the Pumpkin Pie Show?
Clay is a macabre writer, and he has stories to tell, human stories that have a twist. And he uses characters to tell these stories. So there will be music and stories that will weave through. I mean, every year it's a little bit different. So who knows what the 2014 Pumpkin Pie Show will be, but all of them I've been to have been fascinating.
That's great. It keeps you coming back because you never know what to expect, but you know that it's going to be great.
Yes. It's always great.
Well, so you said you mentioned the Firehouse, that that you initially worked with him with the Firehouse Theater. Let's wind back and talk about that a little bit. You worked at the Firehouse as the founding artistic director from in October of 93 until December of 2012. You did so much there. In 2007, you produced the world premiere of Bill C. Davis's Austin's Bridge. In 2011, you produced one of the first productions of Bruce Graham's Something Intangible. And this production, you were featured in the printed version of the script for having done that.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it must have felt wonderful. So what was it like? What was your time there like?
I used to go in and say, I'm the luckiest person in the world to have this job. It was wonderful. It was
And so you were instrumental in developing. You developed their Festival of New American Plays, which every year new playwrights would come and present their original work, and winners have gone on to major metropolitan areas. Tell me about the festival and tell me about some of the winners.
Well, we had we used to get about 250 scripts a year, and we read all of them, and we had readings of the top two, and some of them went on to shows in Chicago and in New York, in L.A. The last year I was there, we were planning on doing a full production of the winner from that year, but that never happened.
Yeah, wow. And so I guess the elephant in the room with the Firehouse Theater is that after more than 19 years, there was an issue with the board, and there was a kind of a publicized forced resignation, and it got national attention and a whole lot of local attention.
Well, it wasn't a forced resignation. It was a forced retirement that I had to retire by June 30th, and so I resigned and it was to be confidential, of course, and rather than go through that donkey dance, I resigned.
Right. And that must have been incredibly emotional for you, being that you were one of the five or six founders of the theater. After you did resign after the forced retirement, a lot of the board members later resigned, and several of the emeritus board members resigned. And a lot of them are actually now with you at Fifth Wall Street Theater. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We have our board members are the ones that resigned, plus some others, plus some long-time patrons from Lorraine Tracy is one of our board members who has been to every show since the very first fundraiser. So she was a longtime supporter. We have board members, patrons. We have a lot of people that are supporting us. All the founders resigned from the emeritus. There were five founders of the Firehouse Theater, Bill Gordon, Janet Wilson, Anna Seneschal, Harry Collette, and myself. Harry now is on the board. Janet lives in Indiana, and Bill lives in D.C., and Anna, of course, has Cadence, but I expect all of them to be on our advisory board, along with Israel Horovitz, who has offered to be on the advisory board. So there's been a lot of support.
Wow, yeah, that's a powerful team. So you're it's got to be tough to start from scratch again, but you're not really starting from scratch because you've built such a reputation and such a team and really kind of an artistic vision that is uniquely yours and yours along with the other founders of the Firehouse. And so that all moving on, it seems that kind of the with the board members leaving that theater, that it's was kind of left in the hands of people who are relatively new to managing a theater. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean,
yeah.
I don't pay much attention. I mean, I was seriously hurt, and it was very difficult time in my life. And I never knew why, and I was never given any reason. So
that is amazing.
I just need to block that out. So
sure, sure, absolutely. Well, there's no reason to look backwards because you've got so much moving forward, and it was
the biggest problem I have right now. I do not have a space, and that's very difficult because just rehearsing, and there's nowhere to rehearse. I really need to find a space
mm-hmm.
so that I can have of acting classes and readings and rehearsal space and community activities, and that'll happen. I'm sure.
So right That's, now, are you sharing spaces with other companies in town?
Well, we're doing our first show at Theater Gym, our second show at Triangle, and we don't know where we're doing our third show. Perhaps at the Theater Lab space.
That's great.
Sure.
I mean, I think it's great that so many people in the theater community really work together, most people, most of the time, seem to really work together and support one another and support the arts and really want to see other theaters and other artistic directors thrive, because I think there's always room, no matter how many companies there are in a city, no matter how many different ideas there are, there's always room for more creativity when you're talking about bringing the arts.
You know, I worked at a restaurant in New York, and it was up in the 90s on the East Side, and it was kind of alone. And then a restaurant opened across the street, and I said to the manager, "Oh, no, a restaurant's opening across the street." And he said, "No, that's good. The more you have, the more people will come to go out to eat. So the more theaters you have in Richmond, the more people will become theater goers."
That's right.
It's important to have a vibrant, and the more talent we have and the more talented actors and designers will stay here. So it's not a competition. And Triangle Players has been incredible to us. Miller and Virginia Rep have been unbelievable. Henley Street, Richmond Shakes, all of it. If you need something and they have it, it's yours. That's the way the theaters work in this town. It's great.
That is so wonderful. So there's so much more art that can be unleashed upon the world, and there's so much more art inside of you and inside of them, and I'm so glad that they're being supportive and sharing and really kind of helping to build up Fifth Wall, because, I mean, you've got such a huge amount of talent in just the leadership without even going to the professors and the director, you know, in just the leadership of the organization itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's move on and talk about your early career, because I think my listeners love to know how my guests have gotten where they are, what fuels their passion for their craft, and you've had such an accomplished career in really bringing some groundbreaking work and some mind-blowing work to audiences in New York and in Richmond and in other places. At what age did you become interested in theater?
Since I can remember. When I was
were your parents
tiny little. My parents, we lived on Long Island, and they went in to see shows all the time, Tennessee Williams and all that. I can just remember putting up the blanket on the clothesline and doing a show with my friends always. putting on a show, just like they say. We had little tutus. We'd do dances, songs, little skits. I always remember doing that from since I can remember.
That's great. Clearly an integral part of your being.
Yeah, well, it truly was. And then I was in plays. I always went to see plays. Was in plays in high school, in plays in college. Even though I was an art major, I was, and one of my costume designers said, "When are you going to switch to theater major? You're doing all theater."
So when did you start studying theater in earnest? When did you switch?
Well,
I
left the first school I went to, which was Miami of Ohio. I went to Penn State. Oh, no, I left Miami of Ohio. I joined a troupe called the Covenant Players and traveled all over the world doing plays for the Army and for churches, and that was for 3 years, all over Europe, all over Canada. That was incredible. We did
that
plays.
That sounds incredible. How did you get hooked up with that group?
I just met them, and it was back in the 70s where they needed somebody, and they took me. I can't imagine
as
a parent now, you know, saying, okay, see you later, and there no communication. You didn't have phones or anything, and I just went off, lived in L.A. and went out from there on tours, spent a year in Europe. But that was incredible because those plays did have discussions, and they had discussions after every play. And a lot of the Army, we worked a lot with the Army, and it was just mind-boggling.
Yeah, to be immersed like that. When you said, like, there wasn't internet, there weren't cell phones, and so to completely be immersed in a culture of theater and traveling the world and seeing the reaction of different cultures to the shows that you were, how many shows did you put on while you were touring around?
Oh, we did several shows a day.
Wow.
Especially when we were under contract with the Army, we might have an 8 a.m. show for 3,000 people, and then we might have a 5 o'clock show for 8 people. It just ran the gamut. It was amazing. But then I got tired of traveling, decided to go to Penn State where my parents lived and study theater. I wasn't happy with the program and somebody there who was who I admired, a grad student there, said, "You should go to the Neighborhood Playhouse." So that's when I went. I just moved to New York and went to the Neighborhood Playhouse and studied under Sanford Meisner, and that truly changed my life.
I mean, Sanford Meisner is such an influential person. His technique is taught in theater programs all around the world, and it really kind of changed, I think, the face of theater for a lot of people. So tell me about him, and tell me about what you learned while you were studying under him.
Well, I'll admit, he was not my main teacher. He came in and out. He was quite old at the time. So I had a lot of classes with him, but I studied with Bill Alderson and Bill Esper and Phil Gucci. And for the first time in my life, I had a method to cling to so that I didn't have to be so nervous on stage, because you're in the moment, you're allowed to see everything that happens, and I'm telling you, this repetition exercise saves you. You don't have to worry about forgetting your lines because you can always repeat. And
so what is the repetition exercise?
Oh, it's an exercise where you learn, the first thing that Meisner teaches you is to listen and respond. So somebody says, "You have on a red hat." "I have on a red hat." "You have on a red hat." "I have on a red hat." It's meaningless, but it's the truth, and it's in the moment. It's not in the past. It's not in the future. It's in the present. And it's like, He compared it to scales, like that you need to practice being the present, just like a pianist has to practice their scales. So it's just an exercise to keep you in the moment.
So to take your brain away from all of the things that are kind of going on in your subconscious and really focus you on what
you're
doing.
Take your mind off yourself and on the other person.
That's great.
So you're not thinking of yourself.
You teach classes on his technique now. What are some of the tenets that you teach when you're doing the classes?
Well, that's what we start with. And we move on and apply that to the text. Sometimes I have them do a repetition and then start the text. That there's also the preparation so that when you have to come into a scene in a certain state, the difference between Meisner and Strasberg was Meisner wanted it from your imagination. You come in and you're imagining, and then you come in this state rather than sensory and trying to dig up something for your past. You didn't think that was healthy, and you didn't think it would work because you would wear it out. So if you use your imagination and think, oh, my gosh, my daughter's just been in a car accident, and now I have to go to the hospital, and you can imagine how you'd feel, it's healthier because it didn't happen. So once you finish the scene, you're all right. But if your daughter really did die in a car wreck, do you want to really bring that up every time you fact that scene?
Absolutely. I've often wondered that about method acting. You know, when you're really kind of tapping into the emotions that you as a human being have felt, especially the negative emotions, it's got to be draining, and it sounds like with the Meisner technique, you're kind of tapping into the unlimited source of creativity within you, which has to give more to the audience.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it can be a physical thing where you just shake something, and that gets you into this state, so you can do that before you go on. But that's only if you have to come in, enter into a state. Otherwise, you go in and you relate and you do, it's all about actions. You do what you're supposed to do and the emotion will come. You don't worry about the emotion. If you are reprimanding your little sister for betraying you, then reprimand and the emotion will come. You don't have to say, I have to get all worked up and I have to cry because I'm upset about my sister. No, you go in and you do the action and the emotion will come.
Very much like life.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And so do you, when you're directing shows, I know you still direct quite a number of shows, do you use that technique a lot, coach your actors to do that while you're in your shows?
A lot of questions in the shows are what are you doing, not how are you feeling.
Mm-hmm.
It's what are you doing, and what do you want? And I never do how does this character feel. I don't do that.
Yeah. So you learned all of these things while you were at the school, and what was the process of that, and then where did you go from there?
From there, I finished school and went on my own to the waitressing thing and took another class with Suzanne Shepherd, who was a good friend of Meisner, and I met my husband, who was taking the class to meet girls. So I met him, and he had some friends that he was forming a theater with, Force 13 Theater in New York City, so I went with them. I did a lot of work in New York, a lot of plays. I was NYU movies and showcases, and it was getting to the point where it was something's got to give because it wasn't anything that was paying anything, and I joined this Force 13 theater company, and we created our own plays through gymnastics. We took some avant-garde plays and added gymnastics and movements and made it very creative. And that's and we did an Israel Horovitz play called Acrobats. And we had a space, and it was a great time.
That sounds great. So, yeah, I mean, I think so many people who want to be in the entertainment industry, especially who want to be actors, they really do get stuck in the space that you were before you guys created this company, where they're getting all sorts of work, and they're busy all the time, but it's not paying anything, and they have to keep a day job in order to continue to do their art, and then they're not sleeping. So do you have any advice there for struggling actors and actresses who are really trying to figure out how to break into this business and make a living at it?
All I know is I was going to all those backstage, which aren't real, like backstage auditions and getting cast every week. And then I went, what's the point of what I'm doing since the productions aren't good and you have to make your own. That's what went. And I moved to Richmond. And I did get cast in Streetcar with Randy Strotterman, and that was great. I was in one show, and then I started taking classes with Janet Wilson, and I said, well, we're doing all this great work. We've got to have an audience. And so we went to Coffee and Company, which is a coffee shop in Carytown, and did some short plays, and then we did a longer play, and then we said, we got to start a company. And can't wait around and go to 60 auditions before you're cast and then don't even know if you like the project. So
right, and it sounds like very beginning that you've been interested in things that kind of stretch boundaries and offer something new.
Oh, yeah.
So it would make sense that you would have that entrepreneurial spirit when you came down here. And so the Firehouse was the product of that discussion?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and nobody was doing much Mammoth. Nobody was doing, at the time, Theater Virginia was not allowed to have any plays with swear words. It was very conservative when I moved to Richmond. And it's not so much now. It's much better. But we decided to do a Mammoth play for our first play at Firehouse, and they said, oh, you're so brave to do that. And since then, of course, we had nudity and different things in it, and we developed an audience for it. It wasn't rejected; it was embraced.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, the transition from what was very conservative to what has become known as a town for the arts over the last 20 years really is it's been so beautiful to see. So, what took you from acting to directing and producing? Like, what was the process?
Well, I was acting in almost all the shows when we started the Firehouse. Then, and I had little kids. I was a stay-at-home mom, and my husband traveled a lot. 7 o'clock at night, I'd get a babysitter. I didn't care about putting them to bed. I was with them all day. So that was just fine. Kids got a little older, middle school, high school. They had track meets. They had things. I didn't see them all day, and I sort of thought I needed to be at home more after school and maybe in the evening. Plus, that's probably not the main reason. I was in a play and acted in it, and then I was exhausted, and then I needed to be home for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to watch out for the artistic integrity of the theater and make sure that everything was top-notch. And I couldn't do it if I was acting in a play, and I had to make a tough choice. And I decided that I was going to concentrate on being the artistic director, getting directors that I really cared about and could work with, going to rehearsals and spending my energy on the quality of the work.
That's, yeah, I mean, sometimes you do reach a point when you're wearing too many hats, and mm-hmm. you can't juggle everything and keep the quality good. So what exactly is an artistic director? What is the job description entail?
The artistic director chooses the season. The artistic director works on partnerships, works on new works, works on developing and expanding the theater. The artistic director assures that each show is the top quality, as top as it can be, makes the budgets for the show, tries to make sure that we can't go around losing money all the time, so you have to make sure that you can fairly produce the show.
Sure. And so do you choose the director and the costume designer and the scenic designer?
I choose the director, and then with the director, I choose the designers along
mm-hmm. with. Wow. So it's a collaborative process, but it all ultimately starts with what's in your idea of what you want the season to look like. So walk me through the process of deciding on doing a show. Say you've decided you want to do this show. How, as an artistic director, do you take it from that decision to closing night of the show? What are the steps that have to happen to make a successful show?
You have to have a right director. That's so mm-hmm. important. You need a team that works together. Theater is always, there are always, I don't want to say crises, but there are always things that you have to compensate for. So you need a group of people who can go with the flow and yet are perfectionists and yet will come in at 2 a.m. and fix the light if they need to, who care about the show as much as you do. So
sure.
You need a crew, and of course you need to cast it well. That's the cast. They're the ones that are out there.
Right.
It's good. I like to have directors who are interested in my input. I never tell a director what to do, but most directors ask me to come to rehearsal and ask if there's any part of the play I don't understand or where I go away, and I might give a suggestion of something that'll make it more understandable. But if the director doesn't agree, I go with the director. I've hired the director. It's the director's project. But all directors I hire are interested in my input. So that's
Excellent.
Another collaborative force.
Sure. And so what is the rehearsal process like? For someone who's never been involved in a show, once you have got your team assembled and you've got the cast, once those decisions have been made, what is the rehearsal process like to bring the play to stage?
So we start rehearsals for the next show, August 4th, and the director and stage manager have developed a rehearsal schedule, and really they only go through about 4 or 5 pages a night.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the directors I work with like to work off book, so maybe the first rehearsal they'll have the book in hand, but the second time they get to that scene, they will have the lines. They will not have the book. Then maybe 2 weeks in, you need a stumble through, run through for the designer's sake so that the
mm-hmm.
lighting designer can see where the actors are, so that the costume designer can see what's needed in costume change. So about 2 weeks in, you have a run-through, not because you're really ready acting-wise for a run-through, but for the designer's purpose. And keep working the show bits by bits until you're ready to run a certain section, then run another section. And then you might have a monologue rehearsal. That all depends on the show.
So do you find that once it's ready and once you've opened the show, does it ever change from opening night to closing night throughout the run of the show?
Yes. And I have many directors who come to every show and keep it fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And if the director's not there, it's the stage manager's job to make sure it stays on track.
Right.
But, I know that my son used to like to come opening night, and he always came again toward the end of the run to see the difference.
Mm-hmm. That's what's exciting about live theater, is that it's,
yeah.
I mean, you know, with a movie or television, something on film, you can have as many takes as you want, but there's only one final product that's all, you know, put together in the end. But in live
mm-hmm.
theater, you know, it's going to be different depending on how the audience is that night. Are they laughing and
mm-hmm.
responding to the lines, or are they not? You know, are they giving applause at certain periods? It's really, I think live theater is just so exciting for that very reason, and that it's always, always amorphous. It's never going to be the same every single night.
And you just gave me a great idea. I think we should let people who've seen it once, if it's not sold out, come for free to see it again.
Yeah, to see the changes. That's a good idea.
Because you need to see it twice. You need to see these shows more than once, because they are different. And also, if it's something that's making you think about it, think how many times people see movies they like.
Definitely.
You can't afford
choosing
to, but say it's not sold out and you have your ticket stub, you come to the theater that night and say, can I sit in?
Mm-hmm.
And that'd be great.
That would be great, absolutely. And you are putting on shows that are so thought-provoking and have such real deep themes that, I mean, I think definitely seeing them twice, I mean, every person is going to miss something in the first run because they just
mm-hmm.
can't take it all in. Sometimes it's sensory overload with a whole lot of things happening on the stage at one time. So,
mm-hmm.
sure, with your work. Yeah, so what draws you to a particular play? What makes you read something and say, this is a show that I want to put on the stage?
You know, it's really my gut. I read a play and I go, oh, my God. And I try to, when I read a play, read it all at once. And
mm-hmm.
it just hits me. And or if I see something like H2O I saw last summer and I went, whoa. And Human Terrain I read and just went, and it's just a gut reaction. And I can't analyze it. I can't. I really can't. I just. There's certain plays, Gideon's Knot, where you read them and you just go, this has got to be done.
Absolutely. Well, and that's that, you know, untapped pure creative energy. I mean, when you really connect with a piece, I mean, it really is kind of a magical synapse that happens between a piece of art and a person you know, when it's the right connection and the right everything, it can really, it really is kind of magical. So what has been your most fulfilling role, whether it's been as an actor or a director, what show? Do you have a favorite?
What show? Oh, gosh. Every time I do a show, I always think of it as my child and like my favorite show. And, oh, it's always so hard to close a show, but, you know, I've just, Gideon's Knot was great, but I was like Jonna, the playwright. I couldn't watch it again. It's just,
mm-hmm.
it was too much. Things that I would see over and over would be things like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? I could have watched that every night. That just was incredible.
Yes.
I I haven't acted in a long time, and I'm thinking it would be fun to get back into it a little bit, but I'm really enjoying directing because I didn't have much of a chance to direct before, and I love directing Lebensraum. That was just a magical experience. That was...
I'll bet, yeah. And that was just recently. And so are you also am I remembering the drama club sponsor at the Maggie Walker Governor
Maggie
School?
Walker, yes.
So what do you do there in school?
I pick the plays along with the students, and then I hire directors and just make sure everything goes smoothly, and then do their one act. They apply to me for one act that they want to direct, and so then I pick the one act and they direct them, and it's just, boy, it's great to be with these students. And in fact, one student who graduated last year is our stage manager for H2O. She's so talented that I hired her. I gave her the job. It's really fun. And my son teaches there, so that's fun to see him. And he's the drama teacher there.
Oh, that's wonderful. And it's
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, to see young people that are so excited and so green as far as having been exposed to all of the wonderful work that is out there, to be able to mold them and have an impact on them, that's quite an honor, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So who are there any playwrights out there? We're getting toward the end of the show, but one more question I want to ask. Are there any playwrights out there whose work you are really eager to stage that you haven't worked with yet?
Oh, that I haven't worked with yet.
Or that you have worked with but that have new works that you haven't done?
Well, I'm really interested in Jonna Adams. She's brilliant. There's so many. You know, Sheila Cunningham, we did one play. She's just so creative. She's just Annie Baker, but she's been done a lot. She's great. I have a bunch in my pocket, but I can't really say right now.
And you also, you know, you're coming up with shows for seasons going on, so you don't want to give away everything you have in your pocket, right?
Oh, no, yeah. It's not that. It's just,
I know.
There's so many. You know.
There really are. And it's that's the one thing in talking with playwrights is that, you know, if you write a book, it's mass-produced, you can put it on Amazon, and people can order it on the Internet, and it can be in, you know, 10,000 living rooms at one time. But when you write a play, it is staged one at a time. It's not mass-produced. It's in one theater in one town. And so it's much more difficult to get a play off the ground and to get notoriety and respect for that play. Mm-hmm. And so when there are people like you out there who are very committed to bringing new work and innovative work and talking to new playwrights and really giving them exposure, I just think it's fantastic because it's really hard to be a writer of plays.
It is.
And so, yeah, to have that forum it's so valuable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, Carol, I just thank you so, so much for being here
tonight.
Sure,
and are you coming August 6th? To our preview party?
Yes, it's the, for those of you in the Richmond area, it is the preview of the season for Fifth Wall Theater, and I can't wait. I can't wait to see and meet everybody that's involved. And this is the Authors on the Air Network. The show is The Authentic Woman. I'm your host, Shannon Fisher, and my guest tonight was Carol Pearsall. And Carol, I cannot thank you enough. I have thoroughly enjoyed this hour. Thank you so much.
Me too. Thank you, Shannon.
Bye.
Bye.
Good night, everyone.
It's the two megastars summer mashup, the awesome iPhone. on the Rockstar Metro PCS Network. Get the iPhone you've always wanted for $0, so you can jam without limits.
It's a hit. Get an iPhone SE on us when you switch. Metro PCS.
Coverage not available in some areas, plus sales tax and $10 activation fee. Requires ported of number not currently active on T-Mobile network or on Metro PCS in past 90 days to an unlimited LTE plan. See store for details and terms and conditions.
It's the two megastars summer mashup, the awesome iPhone, on the Rockstar Metro PCS network. Get the iPhone you've always wanted for $0, so you can jam without limits.
It's a hit. Get an iPhone SE on us when you switch. Metro PCS.
Coverage not available in some areas, plus sales tax and $10 activation fee. Requires ported of number not currently active on T-Mobile network or on Metro PCS in past 90 days to an unlimited LTE plan. See store for details and terms and conditions.